This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'd like now to welcome Dr. George Greer. He is co-founder and medical director of the Hefter Research Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So this is a research institute devoted to the study of the therapeutic effects of psilocybin.
Primarily, our focus is broader than that, but we've come to focus mostly on psilocybin because it is a very potent medicine that alters people's perception and experience of themselves in a therapeutic way and is medically extremely safe because it's used for thousands of years by natives in Mexico and has very mild physical side effects. So it's very safe and very effective for what we're trying to accomplish.
What do we know about how people co-evolved with psilocybin? Is this something that, I mean, yes, it was used by some native people in Mexico. Is it a kind of universal thing? Do our bodies have psilocybin receptors the way we have cannabinoid receptors?
Well, psilocybin activates three types of serotonin receptors. It's called serotonin 2A, 1A, and another one, maybe 1B, I'm not sure. It's primarily the 2A receptor that all hallucinogens activate. So we do not normally have psilocybin in our bodies. There are tiny amounts of DMT, dimethyltryptamine, in our bodies. Psilocybin is phosphoroxy-4-hydroxy-DMT. So DMT also activates the same receptors.
So what do we know, or what do you think about how it's been used historically? Because, I mean, so many people, their stereotype of psilocybin is hippies tripping on mushrooms.
Right. Well, in Mexico, most of what we know is about its use in Mexico, in Oaxaca. And the natives there, the most famous one was Maria Sabina, and that's where the first Western civilization person discovered it, her use. She was a curandera, or a shaman, if you will. She conducted healing ceremonies for people like any shaman or curandera would in any indigenous tribe for physical and emotional ailments, and which included, you know, both physical, spiritual, psychological, it's all together. So that's what those Indians did for who knows how long. Now, these mushrooms do grow in different parts of the world. I understand they're found in England. We don't really know much about what they were used for there in prehistory. So most of the recent use we know about is just in Mexico for healing and spiritual awakening or contact.
So tell us more about what's going on at the Hefter Institute. First of all, who was Arthur Hefter?
Arthur Hefter was a German chemist, and he isolated mescaline from the peyote cactus. So that was, he isolated the first hallucinogenic or psychedelic drug from a plant. And he did that in the 1880s, and he did that by separating the alkaloids of peyote out into different fractions, and then he would test each one himself to see which one was psychoactive. And through that process, he isolated the molecule of mescaline as the active ingredient. So that's why we're named after him. Our president, David Nichols, is a medicinal chemist. And so Arthur Hefter was a chemist. So that's why we're named after him.
Tell us about the research that you're doing at the Institute.
So right now, our Institute, we don't do research at the Institute. All of our research is done at medical schools around the country and in Switzerland at the University of Zurich, currently Johns Hopkins University, New York University, and until recently, the University of New Mexico. Our main thrust is to seek FDA approval for the use of psilocybin to treat anxiety and depression in people with a cancer diagnosis. This is one of the most effective uses of LSD back in the 1960s and early 70s. So we're very far along. We've treated about 80 patients. The last two papers of most of those patients are about to be published this year. And we've already engaged and are communicating with FDA about the next step to do the final called phase 3 study that will lead to approval of this for these patients. The other main thing we're using it for, this is at NYU and Johns Hopkins, is for alcohol-dependent patients or alcoholism. And the first study of that was done at University of New Mexico with about 12 people, and their drinking was reduced by about half, which was extremely dramatic. And again, alcohol addiction was one of the main uses of LSD in the 50s and 60s and was found to be very helpful back then.
I have a question about that. When you say their alcohol use was cut in half, my understanding of alcoholism is if you're an alcoholic, you have to stop completely. You can't cut down to half. Otherwise, you're still an alcoholic.
Yeah, well, some people cut completely. Some people stop completely. Some people stop less than completely. So if you take the whole group, the total amount of use was cut in half. But some people completely stopped and were completely sober. So, and there are different kinds of alcoholism. For many people, it's all or nothing. You know, they take one drink and they can't stop.
Yeah.
That's very common, and that's the most disabling part. For other people, it's not that bad. They can't, you know, drinking less, their quality of lives does improve if they drink less.
So how does it work? How does this chemical make people less dependent on alcohol?
It's an excellent question. It's probably a combination of both psycho-spiritual effects and biological effects. One of the concepts is of quantum change, and this was a concept developed at University of New Mexico. And it's sort of like hitting bottom. In AA, people talk about hitting bottom. They're desperate, and they realize they're powerless in the face of their addiction. So and hitting bottom can be seen as a spiritual, existential spiritual experience in which their whole lives and their perception of it changes radically in a very short time. And so psilocybin facilitates these mystical or peak experiences. And in fact, in the New Mexico study, people who had a mystical or peak experience were more likely to drink less than people who did not, regardless of the dose of psilocybin. So having a mystical experience strongly correlates with improvement in their addictive use. The other use is for smoking cessation, and that's at Johns Hopkins. And that was even more dramatic because smokers, you know, who tried to quit, smokers for years, their smoking virtually stopped. Most of them just stopped completely for months or a year, with maybe, you know, a handful of cigarettes in between. Some stopped completely. So those are small pilot studies of 10 to 15 patients. Now, at NYU, they're going to study 180 patients. 90 will receive psilocybin, two sessions with a lot of therapy before and after, and 90 will receive a placebo. And then at Johns Hopkins, I think it's 40 each will receive either psilocybin sessions or nicotine patch, which is a standard treatment for smoking dependence.
Now, this seems odd. I mean, if you are getting psilocybin or you're getting a placebo, you're going to know.
Oh, yeah. Most people know. At NYU, for the cancer patients, they use niacin as a placebo. And niacin causes flushing in your skin and your body. So people feel something, and they go in with this expectation that there's a 50... In the cancer studies, the patient were their own control. So their first session was niacin or psilocybin, and their second session was the other one. And at Johns Hopkins, when they did the cancer patients, they received either a very low dose or a high full dose of psilocybin. But there's a lot of expectation involved, and at Johns Hopkins, they asked the therapists to guess, you know, did the patient get psilocybin, the high dose or the low dose? And two-thirds of the time, the therapists guessed correctly, but a third of the time, they guessed wrong. So it's not as easy to guess as we might think.
So the patient's subjective experience is also they might not know.
Some of the patients, I don't remember the statistics, but I think most of the patients obviously knew. But some of the patients on the low-dose psilocybin did have some valuable experiences, maybe not a full peak experiences, but some valuable experiences. And they're getting a lot of therapy, a lot of attention. They're at a nice room and a couch with nice music and the full attention of people all day long. So that in itself is a very conducive to a transformational experience.
Let's go back to the research on cancer. So psilocybin has been found to reduce anxiety and depression in people who have cancer?
Yes, it's the same model they have. In terms of the cancer patients, they have only one experience, and with therapy before and afterwards, and screening and preparation. And what we found, and the data hasn't been fully published, but it's reported a little bit, they found is that they have sustained reductions in anxiety and depression symptoms for months after this single session. In both those studies at NYU and Johns Hopkins, it's usually 5 or 6 weeks between either getting the placebo first or psilocybin first with the second session. So at the end of that 5 or 6 weeks, they've shown some dramatic differences in their improvements. So that's how we know that the psilocybin is a critical factor there.
Does it actually affect their ability to heal from cancer?
No. I mean, not that we've detected. It's just they're reframing. And there are a lot of videos on our website at hefter.org showing testimonies by the cancer patients and alcoholic patient about what their experience was and how they feel afterwards. And the cancer patients, they're not worried about dying. They're not worried about the future. They're not so worried about their families. They can just enjoy the present and enjoy life in the present without being distracted by fears and worries and ruminations. So that improves their quality of life for their remaining months or years.
You are a psychiatrist, a medical doctor. You've worked in the New Mexico Department of Corrections. Does doing this work affect your reputation as a professional in the mainstream because you're involved with psilocybin?
Well, no, not in a negative way. In fact, when I worked at the Corrections Department, this is about 20 years ago, when we were starting the Hefter Institute in 1993, the head of of all the adult prisons said, "Well, where are you going to go this weekend? It's when we're going to start this institute to study psychedelics." He said, "Oh, well, maybe we could do that here." So he was very open to that, and I've received nothing from any colleagues or anyone that this is a problem or negative thing. People are supportive and think it's a good thing. And this research was doing very well in the 50s and 60s and early 70s until political influences around the recreational use of psychedelics led the FDA to stop all research. So there's been a gap of a generation when it didn't happen, but it was very promised, and LSD was widely researched back then. We chose psilocybin because it's shorter acting and easier to manage and appears to have the same benefits as LSD.
How did you get into this work yourself?
I had some personal experiences in my 20s in college that were very opening and useful to me. And then in medical school, I went to a long workshop at Esalen Institute by Stanislav Grof, who was maybe one of the fathers of LSD psychotherapy in Czechoslovakia and then in Baltimore, Maryland. And so then I learned a lot more about that and saw it could be done in a therapeutic way. Went to medical school and residency, and after my residency, Stan introduced me to Ralph Metzner, who suggested I do some of this work because I was a doctor, and that at that time, ketamine and MDMA were legal drugs. Ketamine's a prescription drug. So I was able to, through some legal research, to synthesize MDMA in the laboratory of Alexander Shulgin, who was a chemist who first sort of discovered its uses or published on the uses of MDMA. So for 5 years, my wife, Riqua Talbert, and I were able to administer MDMA to people in San Francisco and New Mexico until it became a controlled substance in 1985. So that's how I got started. And then in the mid-1980s, there were a series of meetings at Esalen, which is where Rick Doblin, Dennis McKenna, and I met. And from that eventually originated both the MAPS organization and the Hefter organization.
It's an interesting area of research because I would venture to say, maybe this is wrong, but I would venture to say that most people who are involved in medical research don't get into it from having tried the cure that they are researching.
Well, that's true. And there are some researchers who have not tried these drugs. There's one colleague who's joined our team of researchers who's never had any kind of psychedelic drug, but he has seen the statistical results and benefits with the, especially the cancer patients, in terms of anxiety and depression, and is very excited about it, and so is very motivated just as a psychiatric researcher, even though personally he's had no experience. So, and many of the therapists, I mean, I don't know if any of the therapists at University of New Mexico had ever experienced any psychedelic. And I know other institutions, some of the therapists have never experienced a psychedelic, but still their patients, their clients benefit from that experience. I think it probably helps if the therapist has a personal understanding of what that experience is like and can better empathize and pick up the subtle body language cues or language what's going on. But it's obviously not necessary, because a lot of people have had, you know, one day training from an expert, and then they can help guide the patients, and the patients have good outcomes.
Now, there are so many people whose only experience with things like psilocybin is, what would you call it, recreational use. And a lot of those people are maybe exploring, maybe self-medicating. What is your take on that? I mean, do you think that at this point in history that's a healthy thing to do? It should be legalized? Do you think it's better under a controlled therapeutic setting?
Well, I think it's better under a controlled therapeutic setting. I mean, there's, you know, probably hundreds or thousands of ways to use psilocybin mushrooms recreationally. And one of the things that was discovered decades ago was that the attitude, the intention, the mindset of the person taking the medicine and the situation of the setting where they take it is at least as important, maybe more important, than the drug or the dose they take. So someone who takes mushrooms to party with their friends with alcohol, or to go to a concert, or to drive around, that's a very different setting than someone who's been screened by mental health professionals and is prepared and oriented toward having a healing experience from a serious personal problem. That's like night and day. They're just completely, completely different kinds of experiences and outcomes. And it's been extremely rare, but there have been some very unfortunate cases of people using psilocybin or any psychedelic or MDMA even, where they've had very negative experiences and become psychotic and delusional and done destructive things, or even committed suicide. You know, it's extremely rare, but for those reasons, I personally feel it needs to be used in a safe setting. Now, you know, very, very distantly in the future, I can see, you know, maybe decades from now or a long time from now, that people could be trained and experienced to administer these medicines, screen the people, prepare the people, screen out people who are going to get psychotic and delusional, and administer these safely. But these would be, they would have some sort of license and legal sanction to do that. But right now we need to start with the medical model, because, you know, not many psychiatrists or physicians know how to use these, so we're just starting to learn. But that's the safest way to do it. And as we learn more, that use can expand other medical conditions or psychiatric conditions, other types of licensed therapists using it, etc.
If you had two people using exactly the same drug, one dose of it to somebody administered in a therapeutic setting with doctors in a safe place and all that, and another person using it on their own, you might have two completely different outcomes, is what you're saying.
Oh, you most certainly would most likely have two completely different outcomes. I think the most crucial factor is the person's intention or their purpose for taking the drug. That's the main thing. If they're taking the drug to escape, to get away from problems that they don't want to deal with, that's kind of a prescription for generally a negative, troubling, anxiety-provoked experience of having that problem being kind of right in front of their face and not knowing how to deal with it.
So a person might administer psilocybin to themselves through eating mushrooms or whatever, and they're trying to deal with some horrible, traumatic thing in their lives, and it just makes it worse?
Well, if their intention is to deal with the problem, that's a lot better than to just quit thinking about it. So what I was saying is, if their intention is to, like, get it out of their mind and stop thinking about it, that's unlikely to work.
Right.
And if they try to face it, they can easily and very likely get into areas of their own feelings and memories, recover memories of things they've repressed or traumatic things that could very easily overwhelm them and without someone there who's trained and experienced, and without being prepared themselves, then they could get into a psychotic state or a desperate state or even a suicidal state, because they're just not prepared to open that Pandora's box that might be inside of them that they just don't know about.
Now, have you ever had a situation where in a therapeutic setting, somebody will take psilocybin and get into, I guess, what you're describing is what somebody might call a bad trip?
Yeah, sometimes in the therapeutic sessions, people have had anxiety for some period of time during the experience. But with a therapist there, they're able to, by the end of it, work through and resolve that anxiety and end up in a good place. In our psilocybin experiences, and there's not a case I know of that they did not end up in a good space. I mean, maybe one or two. And if you look at the video of the alcohol subject on our website, she talks about her first session. She was just crying the whole time about, she felt bad about drinking. She was distant from her children and just unhappiness. And she couldn't, in her mind, reach her children or see them for hours. And it felt like months. And then so she, what we call work through, you know, she dealt with and just felt that and just kept going. And her second session was all very positive and uplifting. And she stopped drinking alcohol for the 14 months when we did the video of her. So when people have these peak experiences where they sort of leave their body, leave their ego, and everything becomes unified and they're transcending time and space, it's not like an easy, happy experience. It's a very intense, it can be kind of a, you know, grip your knuckles kind of experience that's not just sort of easy and fun. It's very intense and positive, but it's very intense. So it's not something to be, it's like, oh, I think I'll go have this peak experience this afternoon.
Yeah, this will be fun.
Right, yeah, it's something people's like, that's enough, I don't need to do this again. Often they'll say that.
What do you think leaving your body means? I've heard that expression so many times.
Well, it probably means something different to everybody. What I mean is that people don't feel the sensations, the proprioception from their body. So they don't feel like, okay, my leg is here, my chest is here, my head is here. They just don't experience that sensory input, and they experience they're awake, they're conscious, but the differentiation of the different parts of their body or what's their body and the bed they're lying on just might come all diffuse.
What are your hopes as a researcher at the Hefter Institute for the use of these substances in the long run?
Well, I'm hoping first that the cancer patients, the people with alcoholism especially, and smokers, and then maybe other patients with major depression or anxiety, that this will become a mainstream treatment. And one difference is that psilocybin, you take it once or twice, as opposed to taking an antidepressant or anxiety medicine every day for months or years. So, like the MDMA cure, they have two or three sessions, and I've talked to some of those MDMA patients. They just don't have the PTSD symptoms anymore. I mean, they feel they're cured. And the cancer patients, alcoholics, they feel they're cured. So
The cancer patients feel they're cured.
Of the anxiety and depression.
Yeah.
And so it's an intervention that leads to a lasting result. So that's my hope, that this becomes a part of mainstream medical and psychiatric practice.
What are your thoughts on legalization?
Well, let me separate. The Institute has no thoughts about legalization. We're a purely medical scientific institute. So in that way, we're different from MAPS. We don't do any advocacy whatsoever on any issues. We're a purely scientific organization. Personally, I think that we could have a lot better policies that don't punish people for a health problem and that support people with problems like addiction and abuse of drugs in a more positive, supportive way. And personally, I think we could use our resources of Western society, I mean, all countries, to support healing of people with problems rather than punishment. So that's my personal view. I think before a successful legalization can happen, people would need a lot of effective, real education and understanding. And I've heard secondhand that in some of the states where they legalize marijuana, they've spent a lot of money on educating, especially young people, about the dangers of marijuana, but not saying it's all bad so that they're still credible. So that in some places use by young people has not gone up because of this valid, you know, believable drug education. So I think that there needs to be a huge effort for that because, you know, if you don't talk about it, all you know is what your friends tell you. And then if the government says it's all bad, there's no credibility, so they don't believe the government. They believe they're abusing friends. So that's, in a nutshell, I guess, my personal views.
Dr. George Greer is co-founder and medical director of the Hefter Research Institute. They are on the web at hefter.org. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.